kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello, and welcome to episode 103 of Today in Digital Education, the Tide podcast featuring me, Di Barnes, and...
And me, Doug Belshaw. Di, I've only just noticed when you've turned your video off there, where you Zoom to record this, you've got some kind of Crocodile Dundee style as your avatar.
Have I really?
Yes.
I don't even know what my avatar is, dude. I'm trying to open things up now. Come on, Zoom. Tell me where my avatar is. I can't see it.
Oh, dear.
Open Zoom. Never mind.
Anyway, how are you doing? It's been a while.
All right. No, that's me with my hat on. Yeah, that's me with my hat on, traveling at an airport somewhere. I'm good, thank you. That hat is incidentally, I got that when I was an undergraduate, and my girlfriend, Kerry Sean Davis, bought it at the time, a Welsh girl whose parents lived in Colombia. So she'd been to Colombia and she bought me that hat, and it's Colombian. And it's sitting across the other side of the room right now, and I wear
it. Oh, you still got it? Wow, cool.
Yeah, absolutely. That's how I like things in life at last, you know.
Well, I'm going to talk later on about a book. Actually, I'll just talk about it now. There's a book I'm reading at the moment called Radical Technologies. Where have I put it? I put it in here somewhere. Radical Technologies, The Design of Everyday Life by Adam Greenfield. And it's one of loads of books that I bought. Verso Books is kind of a radical publisher. And so I bought this book on ebook, and it's really nice because you can buy the ebook and the print book as a bundle. And it's not very much more than just buying, you know, one of them, one of the two. And he talks about how things are becoming dematerialized and how much value we used to store in things. And he cites a particular study which was done in 2005, so just before the smartphone. And it was just basically asking people what was in their pockets in Tokyo, in London, in Barcelona, all around the world. That's all the stuff that we used to carry with us, like little photos and our wallets and everything like that, and how everything's been subsumed by the phone. And even more than that, everything from, you know, your web browser to your dating app to... the thing you pay with all has the same look and feel, the same kind of design. So everything kind of has this context collapse, and it's a fascinating book. I'll talk about it more in a moment, but yeah.
All right. No, that sounds
having stuff that we is physical and we really treasure seems increasingly scarce and increasingly important too.
Well, I have, yeah. So when I was, I probably discussed this on Tide before, but when I was a young man, as it were, as in barely a man, I used to love the idea of having things that would last for years and years and years. And when I was on holiday, I bought a pair of swim shorts. And I realized the last time I bought a pair of swim shorts was over 15 years ago. It's just like, and you know, I'm carrying a bag that's 20 years old. I have a guitar with me that's 30 years old. It's just, I kind of like stuff that's old, but it's been mine for,
you know. When there's a story to it, I mean, we've talked about kind of the convenience of Amazon and stuff like that before. And everything for me, especially where I live, and I guess where you live too, like everything's just an Amazon Prime delivery away the next day. So the story behind it is, well, I saw what was on offer on Amazon and I bought it and arrived the next day, rather than, you know, the story about your hat or the story about the guitar or the story about the time when I was camping with my kids on holiday, went to a French swimming pool and they told me my shorts were too long and I had to go and buy some Speedos from the local supermarket for like €3.
Smuggle some budgies.
That's right.
No, that's the wonderful thing. So I've just come back yesterday. So I arrived less than 24 hours ago, back from a week's school trip with in Spain with 24 pupils, and while I was there, so I bought these swim shorts, as I just said, and then I got some chafing on the inner thigh. Not a good look. So we went to Seville for the day. And I didn't want to wear shorts because I didn't want to be, you know, all hot and sweaty walking around town and this thing. So I ended up wearing a sarong around Seville with no shoes on. I was one hippie dude.
You weren't wearing your bamboo cotton.
Yeah, absolutely. And, so the reason I say that is because someone asked me where my sarong was from, where I got it from. And I bought it many, many years ago in Corsica. And then I realized that I have these items of things that I buy in different places and I associate the location of and the purchase, they're like memories, you know. It's like wearing your past on you, or that kind of thing. And it's really nice to like acquire items that you can keep with you and use regularly, you know, things that you like, and that just lasts for a long time. It's a really lovely thing.
I have to say, it's not all like doom and gloom. Like Adam Greenfield, in his book, he's talking about loads of different stuff. The bit I've just been reading was about Pokemon Go and when that came out and kind of layering stuff on top of the world and the problems with that, etc. But, you know, we've talked about this before, but, you know, I use a social network called Path with my family, and it was really ahead of its time in terms of the way that it allowed you to differentiate between different kinds of emojis for response. It wasn't just like on things. And it actually did the, you know, on this day kind of resurfacing photos that you'd shared, you know, a year before, 3 years before, whatever. And I think Google Photos does that now, and Facebook, etc. But I really like those kinds of things too, because, yeah, it just kind of adds a layer into your life of things that remind you of happy or sad times as well.
Yeah. It's just like, it's if you're stacking your layers, I guess, isn't it? You know, it's not like the products I've got are particularly fabulous. It's just that they're mine, and they were acquired at a certain time, and they trigger certain memories, I guess, a certain feeling about them.
There's definitely something about it. I mean, my wedding ring was a resized version of my grandfather, who I never met, my great-grandfather, actually, his wedding ring. And so it kind of carries some of that family history to it. I think we do less
and
less.
Hang on. You say resized version. I don't understand what that means. So is it a new thing?
I mean, I've got small womanish fingers, having never kind of hewed coal out of a mine before. Whereas my grandfather, I actually don't know what he did. It was on my mother's side, not my father's side. So not in the coal mining tradition. But he was a larger man than me, certainly in his fingers. So my gold wedding ring still has all the stamps and everything in, but has been reduced in size, and I presume increased in thickness because of that.
Oh, okay. I'm thinking of buying a ring at the moment. Yeah. Sizing your finger is a difficult thing, because I'm going to buy it online. But sizing your finger is a difficult thing. And then another ring story.
No, it's not, because actually I did this years ago. So when I wanted to... So I've ever told you the story about when I asked my wife, Hannah, so 15 years ago this September, to marry me.
No, you have not told me that story. Go on.
So we got engaged on Independence Day, so July the 4th, 2003 it would have been.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? 2002. And it was on Prince Edward Island in Canada because of Anne of Green Gables. But anyway, I had carried around with me for the 2 weeks before I proposed an engagement ring. And I'd sized her fingers after reading on the internet, such as it was then, about how to size fingers. And so I took a ring, she wore a different finger on her other hand, and then went into the shop, and then they figured it out. But I'd actually already knew kind of what size it was by basically stealing her ring and then finding the size of it. And then, you know, working it out online with a bit of paper around a finger and whatever. In the event, she had to have it changed by one very small size. But you can do it where you can, especially if it's your own fingers, figure out the size of it by getting some paper. You print it out on your printer, the right size, put it around your finger, and then you can figure out the size of your fingers.
That sounds really simple. I like it. I'm going to do that.
Yep.
Because I feel embarrassed about going into a jeweler's and saying, could you size my finger, despite the fact I'm not going to buy any product from you? I don't like that. It's like going to the toilet in somewhere you haven't purchased anything. It's, you know, you're asking a big favor right there.
They should offer that as a service, which it'll be like a bit like... I was listening to a podcast about the decline of Marks and Spencer's. It was actually a comedy podcast. And I was talking about how people only go to Marks and Spencer's for the food and for the underwear these days. And how it, you know, you feel a bit rude getting your bra fitted. This was a female comedian talking about getting a bra fitted and then going buying them online or whatever. People are going to do this. People are going to go into Waterstones and look at books and then buy them on Amazon and stuff, unless there's a sufficient reason to buy them in store. So perhaps people should charge for that service. I don't know.
I think so. But I mean, I get this done with getting my glasses frames adjusted occasionally. And then you always kind of like some shops have charged like £2, some shops have charged a fiver, some shops have just laughed at me when I've asked them if they want any money. You know, it's a different thing, but I guess that is, I mean, it's a service world, and people have to, I mean, as we talk about, you know, machines taking over human jobs, we need to actually identify what is really required in humans and from human people, and that those services are really, really important.
Yeah, no, I agree.
That's why people are there, you know. Hey,
okay,
cool.
So actually, that reminds me of a course I'm doing at the moment. So so I was talking to Brian Mothers a few months ago. Hi, Brian, if you're listening. And he was talking about how he was using, I think, Skillshare, which is one of these kind of online courses, etc. Some online course places are done by experts, and other ones are done by, you know, people who know their stuff, but anyone can make a course. And I think Skillshare and Udemy are two of those platforms. And he was talking about how he was learning how to do stuff in his lunch times and just, you know, committing half an hour every day to learning stuff on this platform.
Yeah.
And my wife was looking, you know, my wife's left teaching now, either temporarily or permanently. And she was looking at different courses. And I saw this one on Udemy. And I think they have offers on quite regularly. But this particular one was supposed to be discounted massively, like 90% down to just over £10 for this product management course, and had rave reviews. And so I was a bit skeptical, but I bought it anyway because of tenor, you know, and product management is kind of what I'm doing now at Moodle. And it turns out it's really, really good. So a couple of people, one is kind of a serial, almost like a YouTuber, but like a serial entrepreneur of those kind of courses. And bizarrely has a... his left arm is kind of amputated. He's got like this black bionic arm, which is pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, no, I can see this little thumbnail of a video previewing the course, and I can just see the black arm in there.
Yeah. And then the other guy, who's less of a kind of a YouTuber, less confident in front of it, but still pretty good, he's a product manager for SoundCloud, so really knows his stuff. And it's a really good kind of melding of the guy who knows how to kind of cut the videos and do high production values with the person who really has the deep dive into the product knowledge. So I'm really enjoying that. I'm about halfway through that one. It's really good.
Cool. Sounds good. I think that's it's really interesting, isn't it? Because there's lots of online stuff out there, and the quality is the king, basically. Content is king, is always in the classroom with digital enhanced learning, basically. So you have to, you know, like there has to be a way of letting bubble to the top the good content, good courses, good things like that, things that people are actually going to find useful to their lives and that kind of thing.
Well, I've been thinking about this, and I've been wanting to write a blog post now, but it sounds so kind of banal and prosaic that I haven't found an angle on it yet. But just the difference between kind of academic learning and professional learning. So I want to say kind of one way of phrasing it would be academic learning is kind of is just in case, and professional learning is kind of just in time. Like, you know exactly what you need to learn, and you find sometimes the shortest way to kind of upskill or get the knowledge that you need to do the thing, which is, you know, in my case, I feel like I could do this role at Moodle without doing the course, but I think I'd be better at it through having the particular language or the particular tools or just having the pointers by someone who's done this before. And that seems a bit different from doing the kind of stuff that we do in schools and universities sometimes.
No, I think that's fair enough. And I think so to catalyze or whatever, to reinforce your point, I think that when you're delivering learning of some kind, or when you're doing something that you just bring your pre-molded skill set to, you always do a better job when you're learning something as well. So the fact that you're doing this course means that you're learning and applying your existing knowledge and new knowledge to your situation, which means you will do a better job because you're in that modus operandi of improving yourself and applying new things as well as the things that you've already got in your kit bag, as it were.
Right, because if you're in a situation, I think, in your professional life where you're not learning stuff, like you're not being challenged or you're not learning new things or from other people, I feel like that's always the time to move on. But in this role, I definitely feel challenged and it's exciting and yeah, it's good stuff.
Good, good. Sounds good. Cool.
So, yeah, just on that, actually, one of the things I've always wanted to do, you know, our co-op does these things called Thinkathons.
I do, yes.
Yeah, so a Thinkathon is like a one-day thing. So on the one hand, it's a bit cheeky because in the world of kind of consulting, often a client comes to you and they think they know what they want, but they don't really know what they want. And your job is to kind of guide them towards something which is going to be a better definition of the project that they want you to work on. And that's a bit of a dance. And I mentioned Brian before. Brian kind of invented this Thinkathon thing where it's like a day, he draws stuff, we kind of dig into it, and then we define what's necessary, and the client actually pays for that day as well. And it's a chance to, you know, get paid for the first time from the client, which is an important thing to do, to set precedent and all that kind of stuff. And we've wanted to do a week-long kind of Thinkathon, a design-a-thon, whatever you want to call it. And have you ever come across something called the Sprint Book?
No.
So the Sprint Book is, it comes from a guy called Jake Knapp, and who wrote this with some other people. And he was at Google Ventures, and he perfected this week-long process where you'd get the right people in the room, and by the end of the week, you'd have a working prototype, which you could then show the world. The idea was that you kind of focused on action. And I've always wanted to do that, and I find the book really useful. It's very visual. It kind of is very practical. It shows you, like, step-by-step what you should do. And so when I wanted to put some rocket fuel into the MoodleNet project, I suggested this. Well, Martin Dugiyama said we need to kind of get an agency involved. And I said, well, what we need to do is do a design sprint. So we went out to five different organizations, and the one that we ended up choosing was Outlandish, who's a co-op. And they took the Google Ventures approach, and they'd never done a design sprint with the client in the room for the entire week. They'd done design sprints, but it's been an internal thing. Mm-hmm. And they took this Google Ventures design sprint, and they kind of tweaked it in a couple of interesting ways. So the first thing they did was, and I wrote a blog post about this, actually, about kind of sociocratic design sprints. I'll stick that in here as well. What they did was, so with the Google Ventures design sprint, I think this could be used in educational institutions, anything like that, like any situation where you want to do something new. You get the right people in the room. And with the Google Ventures one, you have to have a decision maker. That's somebody who's got the kind of requisite authority to say, yes, we're going to go this way or whatever. Now, obviously, in a co-op, it's a bit more democratic than that. So they made this twist using something called sociocracy. I don't know if you've ever come across this before.
No.
So sociocracy is an idea of, there's a process by which you can have democratic governance and democratic decision-making. And I've only ever read about it and only kind of know the theory of it, but they put this sociocratic twist on the design sprint, whereby instead of having one person to decide which way we're going to go, and bear in mind that Martin Dugiyamas, who's founder and CEO of Moodle, was in the room and had flown across from Australia specially to London for the week. They introduced this thing, and it was great. It was, I talk about in the blog post, you basically go round, and it becomes quicker the more you get used to it. But you introduce a proposal, and anyone can introduce a proposal. You get initial reactions from everyone around the table in terms of clarifying questions, everything like that. And then people raise concerns, and then you're asked whether your concern is a critical concern, as in a blocker, something which would force the proposal to fail. And that works really, really well, because you get people to refine their ideas and their proposals. You realize that actually a lot of concerns that people have aren't critical concerns. They're just ones that, you know, they throw up because they're, you know, thoughtful people and they think about what could happen potentially. And it ends up getting faster and faster over the week. And it means that you haven't just got one person who's deciding everything.
Okay.
And then just to finish that off, the second thing they did was that instead of, because this became such a quick process, they decided that we would prototype on Thursday and use a test on Thursday. And we had people like Miles Berry along and someone from London CLC, Christian, et cetera. And then we iterated on it on Friday. So it actually ended up with a faster design sprint. I was very, very impressed.
Okay, sounds really cool. Well, I saw it was a little YouTube video or something that was about about the outcome of the prototyping, and I thought it was really good. It looks really cool. MoodleNet, well done. That's what I say.
Thank you. Well, we used, I mean, it's a bit of a sleight of hand in the sense that they were using, I forgot what the tool's called, XD, I think. It's an Adobe Creative Cloud tool where the designer, Mateus, he was taking our feedback and all that kind of stuff. So you're making something which is a clickable prototype, but there's no code behind it. It's all just like mock-ups, and you click here and it does stuff and whatever. So I don't know if you've heard that Steve Jobs in the 2007 demo of the iPhone basically had to walk things through in a particular order for the demo, otherwise the whole thing would have crashed. It was a bit similar to that with the prototype. Like, I had to go through it in a particular order, otherwise it wouldn't have worked as a kind of a prototype. But it's a good kind of glimpse into the kind of thing that we wanted.
Yeah, no, I think absolutely. So what it provides is sort of an insight into how it will work, how it will perform for the individual. And I just thought it had a real sensibility about it, kind of thing. I'm going to question, I'm just looking at your post here, I'm going to question that Martin Dugamis is wearing an orange shirt.
Oh, well, that's... so what's the name of the road? There's a famous road up near Fensbury Park, which has all kinds of like imported fashion from very kind of multicultural kind of place. And every day we got out of the place and we went out for some food at lunchtime. And there's only, I think it's mainly kind of women's fashion from around the world. But there's one men's shop. And as you walk past it, there was this bright orange kind of silky looking shirt. And he just popped in and bought it like within 30 seconds and came back and put it straight on.
Okay, fair play. We like a bit of spontaneity in life.
Yeah. Just to finish that off, actually, in terms of that story, last time we spoke, I think I was in the process of hiring a technical architect. Is that right?
You were, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so that process ended up being about 70 people applied. We interviewed, or I spoke to about 15 people, and the final interviews were about 3 people. And I spoke to people from South America, North America, Europe, Africa. Places in Asia and Australia was actually outside of the scope of the plus or minus 5 hours, which I specified in the job advert. But the person who I ended up really wanting is the person who got the job, a guy called Mael de Borneo. Mael is from the Basque region and the north of the Pyrenees, and he's the French side. Currently lives in Athens in Greece, but he describes himself as someone who practices slow travel, which I thought was quite nice.
That's a lovely phrase, isn't it? Slow travel. I do like the idea of just taking your time and not worrying about things.
So he's lived in, I think, like Brazil and Cuba and the US and London and all over the place. So, yeah, he really gets into things and speaks lots of languages.
Yeah, he looks like a good guy. He's sort of interested in the world, interested in making the world a better place and all that kind of thing, which is cool.
Yeah, so he's doing 3 days. I do 4 days for Moodle. He's doing 3 days on a 6-month contract. And that's the maximum he wanted to do because he's so kind of committed to other co-op stuff. He actually co-founded social.coop, which is kind of how I knew him before. I put the job on there and he said, well, this looks perfect for me. And it will enable him to also dedicate time to other open source projects, which is perfect.
Awesome. He's saying that one of his favorite places in the world and why is Greece, Athens in particular, and its crazy graffiti and rebellious vibe, and the island where time stands still.
Cool. He's a good guy.
Excellent. I look forward to seeing the product of his labor.
Yes. So you've been in Spain, but you've also put something in here about lesson recording as well.
I have, yeah. So I was approached by a teacher who had said, someone's told me about this fantastic product called Swivel, which is Swivel spelt without the E, and .com. And it is, as far as I can work out, it is a platform for recording video, recording lessons on video. And there's a little gadgety thing that goes in the camera, centers around so you put it in the middle of a table of a small group working in your class, for example, and it will center the audio around that. That will pick up the audio and the camera will just follow it around from the edge of the room or whatever. And which kind of looks cool. And just looking at it now, it sort of looks as though it has it measures student participation. So it's not just observing the teacher and the learning that's going on in the room in a kind of generic, general way, but it's actually looking at it in detail and picking up the contributions made by different individuals, which I guess is an important thing. But if you start to get into, when I did my MA, one of my colleagues looked at group work as his action research, and it was incredibly complicated. So I got to know in detail his research, and it was incredibly complicated, the actual mechanics of group work and handling the variables and all that sort of thing. And but this looks a possible, like it might have some insight into that. However, so my response to her in the first instance was, before we sort of buy into this platform and this piece of equipment, I think it'd be really good if you just recorded a lesson on video and then went through the process of analyzing that to sort of take out from it whatever value that you can glean from video observation. So I have a Zoom camera, which is a wide angle lens and has HD mics on the top, which flip up. And so it will record audio quite well. And it is going to be very teacher centered. And I think this Swivel platform is more student oriented. But I still think people don't understand it. It's a bit like recording sporting fixtures for video analysis afterwards, and you analyze all the plays and this, that, and the other. What the point is that A, it takes a lot of investment of time to get that analyzed and done. And then what value does it actually add to the team that are playing? So I can see how it adds to Newcastle United, and they might want to analyze their play in a different way. In certain ways, but for a school team, I'm not sure. There are more basic things that you can do because you're increasing the skill set from a different place, and the tactics and all that kind of thing. So I just kind of pushed back a little bit and said, right, you record some lessons and do some analysis of those. We can maybe do a bit together. I've done this many times before with teachers, and my favorite way to do it is over a bottle of wine in the evening. And just sort of watch through their lesson and talk about the decisions that they've made and the contributions that they've made through the lesson and what the pupils are actually doing, and sort of focusing on ones that they wouldn't focus on in the lesson because they have their, their hashtag students in the classroom that they're paying attention to all the time, and then they don't watch the people who they think are being really good and always get on with their work. They see sort of mischief elsewhere in the room, and people off task and errant kinds of behavior. As well as their different contributions of body language and how they say certain things and how they come across to the pupils, and just getting out of themselves a little bit. And I think that's a really useful thing for any teacher to do. And every teacher should do that, I think, at some point in their development. It's an interesting thing. So if anybody listening has used Swivel or seen it being used anywhere, I'd be really interested to know what you think about it. And whether you think it's a worthwhile product to invest in and put your time into more than the money, really.
So I was trying to think, have we talked about Swivel before? And I realized that I think someone talked about it at a conference I've been to recently. It was either OER 18 or the OE Global conference. And they were talking about the difference between the two. And I think Swivel's quite expensive, isn't it?
I haven't even looked at the prices because I just want people to make informed decisions.
You know? Well, I don't know about it. So one of the best bits of my PGC tutor, and this was a long time ago, and before kind of such high definition video and things, but my PGC tutor said one of the best things you can do is leave your drawer open in your teacher's desk, put some kind of audio recording device in there, and just record the audio of your lesson and listen back to it. And that, to me, you know, we've talked about the importance when you're recording video of the audio, and we're recording a podcast now, which doesn't have any video, et cetera. But the audio is really important, isn't it, when you're teaching? Because you can feel, especially if you've been in the classroom as well and you've been doing the teaching or you've been the learner in the classroom, you know what the experience was like. And I think even just from the audio in the classroom, like you can feel what it's like, and you can hear what mistakes and what went well and stuff when you're teaching. And I have recorded myself teaching before, but I don't think I learned anything more than just doing the audio. I'm not sure.
I think it's I'm just struck by another conversation that I've had since returning in the last 24 hours, which is something about a product called Project Q, which is just
Q.
The letter, yeah. So
okay,
Project Q. I'll put it in the show notes underneath this so that it can be seen. And it's specifically for EPQ, so the extended project qualification, which we do with knobs on at this school, and it did it my last school as well. And it's a sort of a long form project that the students can get their teeth into, and it has a project log of their journey. And what they did and their research, and they have to go into sort of more academic research, and it's the sort of thing that they might do at university, a bit more dissertation like, but people have done really amazing stuff in it. So we're very fortunate here to have a wind tunnel in our physics department, which is not one that cars go in, but just a sort of small one about a foot and a half in diameter, but they can test aerodynamic theories in it. And so they do that sort of thing. But I've known people have redesigned uniforms for supermarkets and things like that and gone into it that way in a very practical, actually clothes way, that sort of thing. So it's very open-ended what you can do in your project. It's just them getting you on the journey, and you have to obviously write about it and do the research required before the writing, obviously. And then they do a presentation at the end, which is a bit like the same presentation that I did for my MA. When I did my MA, you had to present to your peers rather than do a Viva. Mm-hmm. And you're presenting about your research process and the integrity of your findings rather than about the actual topic, if you see what I mean, the subject of your research. And so I thought this was quite good. But my sort of pushback on the teacher for this was to say, our pupils, so they do it in Lower Six, the big project. And there's another one version at GCSE, a sort of smaller version. And my pushback was that the students kind of like somewhere to hide their work. And what this Project Q platform does is makes the work very transparent, very visible to anybody who cares to see it, you know, so you have to be working on it regularly. And the children in our school get lessons to do this every week, and have a tutor that looks after them. But I just thought, you know, the children like to hide their work away. And my argument was people like to work in sprints, for want of a better word, you know, in a concentrated period of time, for a short period of time. Whereas I could see the benefits of not making them leave everything till the last minute, of encouraging them to do it over a period of time, but that it might just make it so visible it becomes unenjoyable. And because it's not, certainly not how I work. I mean, it's good to work regularly and frequently, but the majority of work that I do outside of, for anything that I do, is I do it in a focused block, and I'll spend a couple of days really focused on that one thing. Like if you're developing a new scheme of work, or if you're doing whatever, you know, I'll push towards that and be very focused on that for a little while rather than regularly.
Yeah, I do worry about all this kind of stuff, because I don't know if you've seen certainly in higher education, there's this real push towards learning analytics. And I think things are getting a bit more nuanced now. But I know plenty of people like you, other people I've known, you know, throughout my life, who, you know, need the deadline, the exhilaration of the deadline almost passing, to, you know, pull their finger out and get stuff done, and they produce high quality work under pressure just before the deadline. Yet learning analytics would suggest that these are unengaged learners who are at, you know, they're liable to fail when
require some kind of intervention. Whereas if people, you know, if people don't trust me to get my work done, I would feel incredibly professionally undermined. Do you know what I mean? It's a little bit weird, isn't it? And a pupil must feel the same, not in a kind of professional way as such, but in the kind of their integrity or character is being questioned in some way. Like they're not going to do what they say they're going to do, which is get the thing in on time. And to a high standard. And it's a difficult thing. So I was sympathetic to the request, but I also wanted to just sort of shine a little light on the idea that that pupils are monitored all of the time. People are watching what they're doing all of the time, because you have, you know, you're doing your classwork, you're doing your prep, and it's being assessed and monitored all of the, and you get into tensions or whatever, you know. And so they're always under that kind of pressure. And it's like, the joy of going to linear exams. So in the UK, we've moved toward linear exams now, away from more modular ones, which essentially means that you're not being examined every year, you're being examined every other year. So you do 2 years of GCSEs, 2 years of A-levels, and now the linear exams mean that the examination is just at the end of the 2 years, which means our current lower six pupils are enjoying a summer where they do have internal exams, but they don't have those, that external exam pressure with study leave and all of that. And it just makes their childhood more childhood-like, in my opinion, and it allows them to have times when their work isn't so good, and they, you know,
I think the important thing here is kind of agency. So
quite human.
I like to work openly, and in fact, you know, since joining Moodle, I've really pushed to be as transparent as possible about all the things that we're doing, unless it's financials or competitor analysis or whatever, things, unless like open by default and then hidden if necessary. But that's me choosing how others can interact with my work. It's not, you know, someone else telling me that that's how I have to work. And I think that's the difference, isn't it? When someone's telling you that you have to work under a process which they can surveil you all the time, and you're going to be implicitly judged all the way through the process, so that if you do choose to leave it till the last minute, then that's a suboptimal way of learning in some way.
Yeah, exactly. It's you know, being human is important. It's just like people work in the way that they work, and it's not the same for everybody. And some people need a push, and some people need a wide berth in a way. You know,
Definitely. We're talking about being human. I wrote a blog post this last Sunday. So we're recording this on, what was it, Tuesday, the 5th of June, 2018. And I wrote this blog post on Sunday, and it was prompted, as lots of my things are these days, from reading someone else's writing. And I wrote a blog post called Where Migraines End and I Begin. And this was based on an article in The Observer by Eva Wiseman. And Eva suffers from migraines worse than I do, but she was prompted by the American Federal and Drug Administration, which is the FDA, approving this potential cure to migraines and talking about her own migraines. And I just told the story of kind of my life and all that kind of stuff, and just how I can't separate out being somebody who, I don't even want to use the word suffer, but like experiences migraines as an event in my life, as a whole body experience, from how I am, because I feel like there's so many ways of being in the world that what we call human, like we've just been described there, varies wildly from person to person, even within the same culture. So, you know, the way that I experience the world is very different from the way that you experience the world. And that's because we have different job roles, but also because we inhabit different bodies and have different relationships with other people. And I guess I was trying to get to some of that through this blog post that I wrote. So no need to discuss that in depth. But the other thing that I did a couple of weeks, was it the week before last, was I bought some new bathroom scales. And I never thought I'd do this, but I bought some body composition scales. And they go into great detail about how my body is composited, which I find fascinating, and has actually led me, just in the same way that when I tracked everything I ate and my weight and everything a couple of years ago on a massive Google spreadsheet, these body composition scales have triggered me into action to actually make a difference in terms of my visceral fat and all this kind of stuff. So, yeah, just I'm thinking a lot more. I don't know if it's like pre-midlife crisis, but thinking more about being inhabiting a body, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, that's partly why I went barefoot, really. I mean, the first instance was I just decided that I needed to, because I obviously abused my body quite a lot, being a smoker and a drinker. But I wanted to invest in my skeleton. I wanted to do things that, so I just, I mean, you know, people think I'm sort of militant or whatever about being or radical about not wearing any shoes. And I really don't feel like it about that. I feel like that about it. I feel just, I'm doing something that makes biomechanical sense to me. It's just pleasurable. And it makes me, it challenges me and it picks me up when I'm down, kind of thing. It's kind of cool. And I like to think that I'm investing. I'm not after immortality or indeed any great longevity, to be honest. I really don't like the idea of becoming old and, incapable of doing certain things for myself, and going out and enjoying a walk or going for a run or climbing a mountain or whatever it might be.
I find it fascinating because, I mean, there's a lot of old people, older people in Morpeth where I live. And when you kind of find out anecdotally how old somebody is, like there's someone who goes to my church who's in his mid-80s, but he's fit as a fiddle, goes golfing all the time, etc. And there's people his same age as him who are like in a wheelchair, obviously haven't looked after themselves and stuff. And a lot of it is kind of genetic luck and other factors as well. But I think it is important to kind of look after yourself. And what you mentioned there about not being militant about being barefoot, I feel the same about kind of not eating meat. Like people, I don't want to initiate the conversation. I'm happy for people to initiate the conversation with me, but I don't really care if they don't eat meat. It's one of my choices that I've decided to make. I think the world might be a better place if we all ate less meat, etc. But I've spent most of my life making the decision that they have, so I don't feel like I'm in any position to judge. It's a different kind of stance, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right, and it's an interesting thing how, you know, different people's takes on different things in the world, and it is certainly a sign of our age, I guess, in that we have this sort of chilled out view about what other people are doing, and we're not being more militant about it, like you should not eat meat or you should not wear shoes. Yeah. And you know, if I start, I just look at people walking and I just think, my gosh, you have no idea what's going on with your feet. Do you know what I mean? If you could see what I can see, it's just like, wow. But I don't get sort of preachy about it sort of thing, but you get to women in high heels or men in high heels, just high heels basically. And I'm just like, my gosh, you really think it's okay? And it's really not. What you're doing to your body is really, really, you know, you look at me smoking with it down your nose sort of thing, and which I understand, and I don't judge people for judging me, but I just think, wow, that's real damage that you're doing. You're really putting your body out of its natural state of functioning sort of thing.
Anyway. Well, just on that, something really interesting has happened on Mastodon this week, which I wasn't going to mention, but I think just in introducing a post that I wrote about someone else's article, this one is called Trust and the Cult of Your PLN, Personal Learning Network. Mm-hmm. But this week on Mastodon, what's happened is the main developer, Gargron, he, or Eugene, as he's known in the real world, as we say, he's the main developer, and he's a bit of a, like a lot of successful open source projects, he's kind of the benevolent dictator of Mastodon. Mastodon is kind of a decentralized Twitter, for those who don't know. And this week, he's developing this all the time, and he's taking people's feature requests, etc. And one of the feature requests was a bit like Twitter, having a trending hashtags thing. Now, okay. I didn't realize this, but trending hashtags often on Twitter leads to people discovering stuff that they wouldn't have otherwise discovered, which is good, but also people piling into conversations and a lot of abuse as well. Mm-hmm. So it's actually led to, I'll spare you the drama, but basically it's led to a group of people deciding that this guy should not be in charge of the whole project, and they're going to hashtag fork off. Forking, okay, being, you know, taking the code from the open source project and making their own version of it, which is kind of hilarious. Anyway, it's a very serious kind of thing, but it made me realize that there's a lot of, you know, what we've previously called kind of echo chambers going on in the social networks in which we use. And even when we use things like Google, it's kind of, if you're signed in, it's showing you things which it's learned that you like. So you end up in this kind of filter bubble, and that's the term which Eli Parizio used in a TED talk from about more than 5 years ago, I think.
Yeah, it is. It's a long time. There's but it's absolutely accurate. Do you know what I mean? The way that, but the thing that I always get to when I'm thinking about this sort of thing is that even though the filter bubble means that there's an homogenization of thought really going on in opinion, and it's subtly and unconsciously or without consciousness, steers you towards a certain position or whatever, a position of thought, is that the technology, even though it's doing that, it's still, that's what we had before as well. You know, you think, so when I grew up, before technology was taking its grip on the world, like half a dozen newspapers and two or three news channels on the television, and then radio news as well. Mm-hmm. And this is where you got your information from. And that information was highly sanitized. You know, it had been through this filter, and there was filter bubbles going on. The issue now is that the filter bubbles are subject to influence from places that we're not necessarily aware of. But still, that kind of influence existed back in the day as well, with these media moguls that exist, like Rupert Murdoch and other such people.
No, absolutely. And deciding, it's really interesting when you have kids who are kind of the age of mine, who are 11 and 7, who ask very simple questions about why the world is the way it is. And of course, there's the flip side of that, which is they don't question some of the things that, for example, Adam Greenfield was talking in his book about how mobile phones mediate the world. So I realized on the way home tonight, walking my daughter back from her piano lesson, that we passed lots of people who were just on their mobile phones walking down the street. She's 7 years old. She was born in 2011, 2 years after the iPad, 4 years after the iPhone. She's grown up in a world where adults are on their mobile phones a lot of the time, and she doesn't even question that. But she does question, like, how do people decide what goes on the news?
Well, that's good.
Yeah, which I found interesting. Now, this particular post, The Trust in the Cult of Your PLN, is my thought shopping post, kind of summarizing one which was in Aeon. Now, Aeon is kind of a philosophical online magazine. And this particular article was by a guy called C. Tai Nguyen. He's an assistant professor at Utah Valley University. And he, obviously, as things progress, people start getting a bit nuanced in their use of language. And I wondered if we wanted to kind of just take a couple of quotations from him, just to tease apart the difference between echo chambers and epistemic bubbles. Maybe you take the first one, I take the second one.
Okay. Where the hell are they?
Well, I'll do the first one while you kind of look. So he says that basically echo chambers and epistemic bubbles, the two things have been conflated. So he says, let's call them echo chambers and epistemic bubbles. Both are social structures that systematically exclude sources of information. Both exaggerate their members' confidence in their beliefs, but they work in entirely different ways and they require very different modes of intervention. An epistemic bubble is when you don't hear people from the other side. An echo chamber is what happens when you don't trust people from the other side.
Okay. Right. I apologize for my dislocation there. I didn't know where it was. It's just these aren't in a list. That's why I didn't. I was talking about. Okay. Yeah. Makes sense. Epistemic bubble and echo chamber, slightly different things with a similar result, possibly. Okay, next one. Current usage has blurred this crucial distinction, so let me introduce a somewhat artificial taxonomy. An epistemic bubble is an informational network from which relevant voices have been excluded by omission. An echo chamber is a social structure from which other relevant voices have been actively discredited. In epistemic bubbles, other voices are not heard. In echo chambers, other voices are actively undermined. The way to break an echo chamber is not to wave the facts in the faces of its members. It is to attack the echo chamber at its root and repair that broken trust.
Right. So basically what this guy is saying is that what Eli, the way that I understand what this guy is saying, is that what Eli Prezia talked about as being echo chambers, he's calling epistemic bubbles, which basically means that we're on Twitter or Facebook or Mastodon or whatever, and there's some voices that we don't hear because we're in this epistemic bubble. But what we're seeing with kind of Russian interference in elections is an echo chamber, which is basically saying you can still hear the other people's voices, but they're being undermined and discredited. So, you know, Hillary Clinton in the 2016 presidential campaign, or people who voted Remain or were going to vote Remain in the Brexit vote. Like, those people were heard by the opposition, but undermined as well. And that's what's happening increasingly. It's not the case that you just don't hear the voices. is that you hear them and they're undermined. You're given a slant on the world before you hear the information.
Mm. I mean, but it's interesting how this manifests for our lives, for the life of the average Joe, not that such a thing exists, but for you and I and everyone else. Is that when you're trying to get your head around an issue that you need to participate in, like an election, that you need to really step back from the media and find sources of information that are trying to discuss the actual things that are at issue, the policies or whatever it might be. And the problem with that is that often, so even when you get into the academic discipline, so you get into the economics of a policy, for example, people just have very distinctly different opinions about what will work, what policy would be effective, what strategy is going to have a desired outcome. Quite often, the outcomes are aligned. So the outcomes of two different policies will claim to be the same thing, but the path toward them or the method by which you achieve them is completely different and is based on different principles. And it's those principles that you have to align yourself to and think, that's how I want, that's the one I want tried in this arena, this society, this governance, whatever.
The really interesting one is when you flip those two and you find an outcome which is acceptable to people across the political spectrum, but for very different reasons. So for example, something like I read Utopia for Realists recently, and he was the guy, Rutger Bregman, was talking about universal basic income being something which is acceptable to the right and the left of politics, but for very different reasons. The left, because, you know, we should have a more egalitarian society where no one's left behind, but the right, because we should not interfere in people's lives, and we should leave people alone, but giving, you know, kind of give them the means to not interfere with their lives, like not means test them, you know, kind of more of a libertarian approach. So I really
I'll just question that. So the right, I would argue, also says don't interfere with business. That's one of the issues that I have with the right.
Right. Okay. But the point is still that you try and find a solution in scare quotes, which appeals to people for different ideological reasons. Yeah.
Yes. 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 Absolutely. And that's that.
So
are we going to align?
Yeah, I just want to go on to the next quotation, actually, because if you remember during the Brexit vote, Michael Gove famously said that, you know, we shouldn't trust experts anymore because you know, what do they know and what have they ever done for us, kind of thing, in a Python-esque kind of stance. But this guy says, and the guy says, as Elijah Milgram argues in The Great Endarkenment from 2015, modern knowledge depends on trusting long chains of experts, and no single person is in the position to check up on the reliability of every member of that chain. Ask yourself, could you tell a good statistician from an incompetent one, a good biologist from a bad one, a good nuclear engineer or radiologist or macroeconomist from a bad one? Any particular reader might, of course, be able to answer positively to one or two such questions, but nobody can really assess such a long chain for herself. Instead, we depend on a vastly complicated social structure of trust. We must trust each other. But as the philosopher Annette Beyer says, that trust makes us vulnerable. Echo chambers operate as a kind of social parasite on that vulnerability, taking advantage of our epistemic condition and social dependency. End of quote.
No, I think that's absolutely right, isn't it? I mean, I have no idea. There's nothing more... It's embarrassing when you pitch your conversation aligned to a certain expert, and then somebody in that conversation is able to completely undermine that expert and just wash them out, essentially, which is what I have done to people in the past. So because I have greater knowledge of digital arenas than others that I work with, and they will cite somebody and I will say, yes, but this person is proven to be disingenuous in their sources and their claims. And you just sort of pull the wind from the sail, as it were. And it's not a nice position to be in. And I think that's absolutely right. It's how do you judge the quality of the expert that you're being that you're consuming, so reading or listening to or whatever. And I think that's important because that is the thing that we want our media organizations to curate for us. You know, if you hear an expert on the BBC, you want them to be an expert that is respected in their field, not somebody who's on a whim, as it were, and trying to further their career or whatever, and without much substance to it. That's a difficult.
Well, we saw this with Brexit, didn't we? Nigel Farage was on the TV all the time because he pulled in audiences and ratings. Very controversial kind of character, but didn't really represent the majority of people's views, but kind of became normalized over time. And what you just mentioned there in terms of attacking facts, like facts are now seen as this kind of fungible commodity, which is free floating and everyone can quote their own fact. And so just the last quotation I've taken, it says, Nagoyan says, is there anything we can do then to help an echo chamber member to reboot? We've already discovered that the direct assault tactics, bombarding the echo chamber member with evidence, won't work. Echo chamber members are not only protected from such attacks, but their belief systems will judo such attacks into further reinforcement of the echo chamber's worldview. Instead, we need to attack the root, the systems of discredit themselves, and restore trust in some outside voices. End of quote. So he basically says, he's insinuating that we don't need technologies like blockchain. We don't need to develop a trustless society. What we need to do is to help the person who's stuck in the echo chamber, in the epistemic bubble, whatever, to start trusting some voices outside of that echo chamber, rather than just attacking their beliefs and pointing to fact. Because I don't know anybody, and he says in the article, he doesn't know anybody who, when you point to facts, just goes, oh, well, I'll just believe the exact opposite of what I've just believed then.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's really important, isn't it? Everyone has a responsibility. If you're going to consume media, that you consume quality media. That's the thing. And so I was just thinking about so I'm a big fan, as are you, of investigative journalism done by The Guardian and The New York Times and that kind of organization, media outlet, basically. But one of the things, they're not... You know, they do include the words of Farage. They do these things at the time when there's a sort of crest of a wave to be ridden. You know, when there's an election, they need to pump out repeated stories every day on the same topics. They are subject to such indiscretions as well as of bringing attention to experts that don't necessarily help you form a balanced opinion about whatever the issue is. But when they're not having the spotlight, what the investigative journalism allows them to do is to go out in the sort of cold light of day, as it were, and go and find something that is worthy, newsworthy, and investigate it and put a lot of resources into it and explore it. But still the same media outlet can, at a time of, I guess, when the news is busy and, you know, it's all about one thing and their attention is directed at something like Brexit, like the American elections, whatever, that they're less scrupulous about the quality of what it is that they are delivering. So you do get this echo chamber.
Business model that we've talked about before. So on the internet, it's advertising. So what has happened since we last spoke? Well, GDPR's hit, hasn't it? So I was hoping that would lead to a lot less spam in my inbox. I think there is slightly less, but I'm still getting, I think I'm on the wrong mailing list. I'm getting adverts for yacht charters and private jets. But
welcome to the world of privacy. That's the thing. So if you say, I don't want any targeted stuff, thank you very much. So you're always opting out and the stuff you're getting is very generic, I'd say.
Yeah, right. Okay. So, but what GDPR should do, and I did see, I think Doc Searles wrote about this. He was talking, it should lead to the death of ad tech. So their kind of advertising technology bubble. So if you go to, you know, even sites like The Guardian that serve to expose what Facebook is up to, etc., have a multitude of trackers on their site, which post GDPR should be a lot less. In fact, I'll not be able to find it quickly, but there was an American news site, which in the light of GDPR basically said, oh, we see that you're accessing our site from Europe. click here to get a basically a trackerless version of our website. And it's really, really quick because it's not loading so many trackers and JavaScript and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So where was I going with that?
Don't know.
Completely forgot.
GDPR emails.
Yeah. So
well, my take on the GDPR email is that so I'm just not answering any of them other than Laura Hilliger's newsletter. And I'm just curious how many people are going to switch me off their mailing lists, which I imagine is going to be none.
You reckon? Well, I did actually, yeah. Because I thought I was completely covered by MailChimp's. Like nobody's, I didn't think that anyone had signed up for, I hadn't added anyone to my mailing list that hadn't signed up. And then MailChimp basically said, oh, look, there's these 300 people or 250 people, whatever it was, that we're not sure how they ended up in your mailing list. And I couldn't remember how they ended up on there. And then I got in touch with them saying, oh, look, you're going to have to click this button. I'm sorry, you're getting lots of GDPR emails. And Tony Shepherd, hi, Tony, if you're listening, who works on GDPR stuff for schools, basically said, oh, my goodness me, I definitely signed up to your email newsletter. I don't know what this is talking about. And so I reckon I've probably lost about 200 subscribers to my Thought Shrapnel newsletter. Because I basically had to do what MailChimp suggested, which was take them off my mailing list because I didn't have the GDPR proof opt-in, whatever.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Well, there we go. I don't know what that is because you didn't send me that email. So clearly But Tony opted in as well. This is the thing. I don't think I would have done anything different to Tony. There aren't that many options when you opt in. You know what I mean? You just put your email address in and then verify it. And so it must be, it's interesting that behind the systems or behind the scenes is MailChimp's system, which must not be consistent.
Well, it might be something to do with, you know, like you download your subscribers as a CSV file and then you re-upload them at some future time into MailChimp and then it doesn't know where you've got the consent from. I don't know. It might be something like that.
Oh, okay. I see. So it depends on the timing or something like that. It could be some variable like that, but still it is a behind the scenes service and something's going on where they've lost recognition that our email address has actively verified that they want to receive and which is what the verification emails are for, obviously.
Yeah. Okay, where should we go next? There's a few left in here we can talk about.
Is he looking at trust and the cult of something, the PLM? What was I thinking of that was relevant? No, let's go and do that. So should we just go on to academic innovation?
Yeah. This one on academic innovation is a bit of, it's, as Americans would say, a bit inside baseball, especially for higher education. But the idea is that there's a guy called Roland Moe, and he wrote a really good post, which was picked up by Audrey Waters and other people last year. Very good writer, and he is the director of the Institute for Academic Innovation at Seattle Pacific University. So has skin in the game when it comes to, quote-unquote, academic innovation.
Uh-huh.
And he is actually warning that it's not necessarily a great idea to create a new discipline, you know, academic innovation, because until pretty recently, being innovative was actually a negative slur. And we should pay a bit more attention in terms of the history of stuff rather than just kind of going gung-ho. So I was a bit skeptical when I first read this, but then I realized he's actually making a pretty subtle point. And the point he's kind of making, the point behind the point, as far as I'm concerned, is that we're increasing kind of business processes around innovation and disruptive innovation and Clayton Christensen and all that kind of gospel to what is fundamentally a human, a societal good, which is higher education. So I don't think we need to, I don't know what you took away from this, but I don't think we need to read all of the quotations I've selected from this particular article. What do you think?
No, I don't think we need to read them. But I just think it's an interesting thing. So we can just pick some little bits out of that. So you get a flavor of the article. So if the goal of academic innovation is to be creative and flexible in the development, discovery, and engagement of knowledge about the future of education, the foundation for knowledge accumulation and development needs to be innovative in and of itself. That must start with an operational definition of academic innovation, differentiating what innovation means to education from what it means to entrepreneurial spaces or sociological efforts.
Yeah. So to me, he's basically saying, okay, well, let's just define what we mean here. Now, sometimes when academics say, what do you mean? And let's have a conversation about definitions. It gets very boring very quickly. But I think what he's saying here is, well, if what we're talking about is innovation, but really is about introducing kind of the neoliberal marketization of higher education under the umbrella and Trojan horse of quote unquote innovation, then that's not something we need or want. Whereas if it's actually about doing new things in new ways and using technology to further enhance and widen access to higher education, cool, let's do that. But let's actually define what we're talking about here.
Mm. No, I think it's important. So I think thinking about the idea of progressive, so a progressive teacher or progressive pedagogy. And so the principle of progressive could be defined as something that makes progression. So you're taking the idea of what happens in education at the moment, whatever level it might be at, and whether are we going to build upon that? Are we going to take it anywhere, make it anywhere, in any way, shape or form different? And if we are going to do that, then you are progressive. That's what you're doing. And if you're not going to do that, and you're going to say everything that I need to teach my subject has already been worked out, and I'm just going to use that, then you would, I effectively think, be traditionalist. But I would hark back to the point that we made 10 minutes ago or something about the idea, were you talking about doing the Udemy course, and the idea that you're not just bringing your existing skill set to the table of the work that you're doing, but you're actually learning new things and you're applying that and merging it all together and taking the best of all of it that you see fit. And that process of you being progressive in your work, you personally, brings with it an energy that catalyzes the process of the work that you're doing for Moodle and makes you a better, more productive employee, a more effective practitioner, whatever. And I think that's an important thing about this as well, is that when you're looking at, so when people are saying, let's bring in innovation after innovation, you know, should we bring in the swivel cameras? Is that going to have any effect on what we do? Yes or no? Well, it's always going to have the effect of being progressive of the individual who's adopting that process and wants to bring it into their practice, into their lives. They're going to be bringing on this new thing and they're going to be excited about that. They're going to be energized by it. And that's going to have an impact. And you look at the Hawthorne effect and that kind of thing. When you look at research, you know, things have impact because they come with energy and enthusiasm from certain participants in the research process and that kind of thing. And this is where this post is sort of interesting, is yes, let's have innovation. Let's allow people to innovate. Let's keep the doors and windows open, but let's not shy away from the fact that we know where we're at and we know what we're doing. You know, be confident about what it is.
Yeah, definitely. And I just want to bring in a quotation from Adam Greenfield here, who wrote Radical Technologies. He says, quote, in our time, even the most seemingly transgressive visions of technology in everyday life invariably fall back to the familiar furniture of capital investment, surplus extraction, and exploitation. We don't even speak of progress any longer, but rather of innovation, end of quote.
Yeah, I think, is it just a buzzword? Is it? I don't know what it is. I mean, innovation, I think if we reduce it to its definitions in any context, is going to mean something new. And I just think people like to do something new. They like to experiment with the best of what they perceive, or what they perceive to be the best of what's out there, but also to bring those things together, sort of remix them, mash them up into something new, I guess, you know,
make connections. What I think is interesting about what Greenfield's talking about here is that when you talk about progress, it's always, well, progress for whom? And the progress has an object, and the object is humanity or a subset of humanity. Whereas innovation seems to kind of be floating free and something which is future-oriented but doesn't really have an object. It's like innovation doesn't have a subject to it. It's just something new for the sake of new's sake. So when you hear of, I don't know, people logging in or signing in for their lectures by using their fingerprint, or Amazon having a system whereby the Amazon Prime driver can gain access to your house to drop off a parcel. It's all kind of just subsumed under this umbrella of innovation as you know, we should all bow at the altar of innovation and just accept it because it's a new thing, rather than questioning and critiquing it. And I think that if we actually use the lens of progress, then we could talk about, well, for whom is it progress? Is it progress for a particular subset of people who are focused on, as Greenfield says, capital investment, surplus extraction, and exploitation? Or is it actually for the good of society?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really interesting thing, and something you need to be really skeptical of with innovation. So I was just thinking about a lot of innovations maybe take away from the idea of reading in the classroom and reading as part of learning. And when you think about it, reading is an essential part of learning, and it's something that people are becoming less and less good at, I might argue, although I was never very good at it personally. I don't know. You know, reading could not be like a system, procedure, a process that brought reading back to the front and center of learning would be progressive, but not necessarily innovative.
Right, exactly. And a couple of interesting things on that. So I read this week that women's glossy magazines have just gone off a cliff since kind of more women are using, and it's not just obviously women, it's men as well, but I was reading about women's magazines, kind of gone off a cliff since things like Instagram and Pinterest and whatever, things which are always up to date and constantly being refreshed on their phones, kind of and available for free as well at the point of access, have kind of subsumed the weekly glossy magazine. The other thing I'd point to is that since we've taken my son's smartphone off him, he has reread 6 of the 7, is it 7 Harry Potter books? In the last few weeks, you know, because, and what's a better use of his time? Yeah.
Well, reading something else.
just to finish that point, actually, there's a related post, and it's called The New Octopus. I think that's right. There's a wonderful, it's in Logic magazine, which is great. And Ian O'Byrne pointed me towards this in his TLDR newsletter. And the author of this is someone called K. Sabil Rahman, who's an assistant professor of law. And I quote him at length in this particular post, but he talks about how, quote, moving fast and breaking things, which is, you know, what Facebook's mantra was until recently, moving fast and breaking things is inevitable in moments of change. The issue is which things we are willing to break and how broken we are willing to let them become. Moving fast may not be worth it if it means breaking the things upon which democracy depends.
Well, I think that's quite interesting, isn't it? I mean, I take issue with the idea of democracy. I don't think it exists in the way that we believe it to. But and I think this has happened quite a lot, is that, you know, society has moved too fast and broken democratic principles and necessary and strength, basically, to make it. I mean, things don't feel democratic anymore, even though they are. But, you know, Donald Trump gets
elected. What would you call kind of the, I don't like the phrase, the rule of law. Do you call it like civil society or?
Yeah, I don't know. I really do feel that in this day and age, and I'm not 100% sure it's a bad thing. I don't think we need to apologize for things costing money and, you know, people making their money and things like that. But the really big corporations, which is also a difficult thing for me to argue because I work in technology, and the big corporations, Google, Apple, Microsoft, Facebook, whatever, are the ones dragging technology forward at pace and providing the tools that you and I use to record this podcast, as well as among other things. Not that they're providing our specific tools, but, you know, the technologies have come on because of the technological innovation, that word again, that has happened for different reasons. but driven by these big tech corps. So to criticize them is really, really difficult. But you do feel that the large global companies are really, that globalization is really at the heart of capitalist rule. And I think that's the thing I would argue is really in, it doesn't matter which political party get into power. It doesn't matter about these things. Do you know what I mean? And this democracy is an illusion in our lives. And
I think we definitely need something a bit more nuanced than the very simplistic democratic system we've got at the moment. I was walking past. So my wife and children went down to Devon to visit the in-laws, and I was left alone for 3 days, which was both great and terrible in equal measure. And while they were away, I picked up my son's prescription from the doctors, and all I had to do was give his name and address, and they just gave it to me on trust through the NHS. And then I walked past the community center where I would go to vote if I didn't do postal voting. And I know for a fact that if I turned up there, I would just have to, I don't even have to have the thing that comes to the door. I can just give my name and address, and I'd be trusted to kind of be able to vote. And so people sometimes think, well, that's terrible, and we should put everything on the blockchain and we should invent new technologies. But actually, trust has worked quite well up until now. And I think we actually need to progress in the way in which we allow voting to take place. So, for example, single transferable votes, where I give Di my vote on a particular thing because Di knows more about that area than me, but I can withdraw my vote from him and he can block vote with 500 votes because he knows about this particular area. And we can vote more maybe than before and have a bit more direct democracy. Uh-huh. But I think that some of the things that internet giants give us has become normalized as kind of everyday behaviors because there hasn't been very much pushback from people who are resisting the logic of capital. So you talked about globalization, but a lot of that is to do with needing new markets and running out of markets and runway and that kind of thing, and therefore having to put up balloons over Africa to give people internet access so that more people can sign up to Facebook or whatever it is. Like, there's a particular logic to it that is being resisted, but it can only be resisted by things of a similar size. So like the EU enacting GDPR, like a single country couldn't really do that unless it was the United States maybe, but we need things of a comparable size, which is why I think that one of the things that this article is talking about, the Octopus one, is talking about kind of using anti-monopolistic legislation against large organizations such as Apple and Google and Facebook, etc.
There are regulations out there that would do it. And I went to France a lot as a kid. I'd say a lot, six times growing up, something like that, on a summer holiday for 2 weeks each time, whatever. Nothing posh, caravans and that. and which was lovely. I loved it. But I was always really respectful of France. People are very anti-France in our country generally, in comedy and in the media and things like that. And I never really got it. I just thought it was what an amazing place. It's all good. They coffee, cigarettes, wine, cheese. What's your problem? Sunshine, sea, come on. It was all good to me. And I didn't find French people rude at all, the ones that I met and spoke to and whatever. Anyway, so I kind of think that, why on earth am I talking that? And also about Italy as well. So in Italy, they have this, I don't know if it still exists, but they certainly did have this regulation by which, if you were cooking food in a restaurant, 15% was allowed to be sourced nationally. 85% of your produce, the stuff that you put on a plate, had to be sourced locally within a certain region, and which was a sort of a sort of radius from where the restaurant was located, and I just thought, wow, that's just very sensible and very fantastic. Why is it that people aren't taking these rules and making these rules part of the society in which I live in? I don't really understand it, and I understand there's complexities to it, and I'm an economics graduate, and blah blah blah, but still, the principle exists whereby you could really support your different regions within the by doing so, and support industry in with a very small.
It's a difficult balance, though, isn't it? Because like, historically there's a certain amount of protectionism. So I'm thinking like the Boston Tea Party. I'm thinking about like Palmerston's gunboat diplomacy. I'm thinking about all kinds of stuff like that. Where I'm thinking about EU laws around where you can sell pasties and where you can you know, what you can talk about as being pesto or mozzarella or whatever. Like there's a definite balance between protecting stuff, encouraging certain kinds of behaviors, and this kind of paternalistic approach, which reduces, I don't want to use the word innovation now, given that we've just talked about it negatively, but like reduces progress. Like it can still defy things. So I was reading today, I think it was in Greenfield's book actually, about James Watt, and when he invented that steam pump, they had to wait like 20, 25 years until the patent expired before everyone could use it. And then there was this like Cambrian explosion of steam pumps everywhere.
But I think that, sorry, carry on.
No, I'd finish, sorry.
But I think that, you see, this is an interesting thing, isn't it? Where innovation should never be the subject. Do you know what I mean? Progress should be the subject, and innovation should be tested against progress. It's this big thing. You know, everyone should be talking about the litmus test for progress, and that innovation will be progressive. Therefore, this innovation is a good thing. This one, not so good. And because it doesn't meet the progress measures, it's a difficult thing. And I think it's important to mention, as you said there, talking about the EU, to reinforce the idea that the general data protection regulations are the best thing that we have had going in this regard for a long time, if not ever, you know, in sort of policy that is going to push and bite against tech corps, you know. All corps, not just technology ones.
The difficulty is, though, that there's like the market is seen as this kind of mechanism by which we can see what works, and it's not one organization or one government or whatever imposing its worldview on people, and that we've got things like GDP in which we can rate the success or failure of different countries. But obviously anything that can be measured can be gained. And so GDP kind of forces countries and decisions down a particular avenue. And obviously markets can be monopolized and gamed and that kind of thing. So what I feel like we need are things we can adhere to, which, going back to the conversation we had before, whatever your worldview, you can agree that this leads to progress, human progress, rather than the enriching of the 1% or whatever it is.
Yeah, and it's all very complicated.
Oh yeah, definitely. And we're pontificating here as if,
because there are those that believe.
Yeah, you're right, it's very complicated.
Yeah, no, well, that's the thing about systems
change, just to move things on. I came across this thing, and the original kind of theory is from 1987. And it's called the Managing Complex Change Model. And I went down a bit of a rabbit hole. I think there was a post by Tom Critchlow on Hacker News or somewhere, which then linked to somewhere else that told me to this thing. And it's a diagram. So if you're listening to this podcast, you should go and have a look at this diagram. I'm not sure I completely agree with all of it. I think that anxiety, for example, can be caused by, well, certainly anything in my case, but different things to what it is described here. But I really liked in terms of the way that the stance it took in terms of how systems change takes place. I don't know if you had a chance to look at this, Di.
No, I've not seen this. I'm just trying to read it carefully. So to give a flavor of the diagram, it has 5 different columns of boxes, and it's arguing that to get to change, you have to have all 5 different elements in place. And those elements are vision, skills, incentives, resources, and action plan. And if all of
right, so if you don't have vision, it leads to confusion. If you don't have skills, it leads to anxiety. Yeah, if you're missing incentives, it leads to resistance. If you're lacking resources, it leads to frustration. And if you haven't got an action plan, it leads to false start. So I thought it was just a nice way of conceptualizing, you know, if you're feeling frustrated, well, maybe it's because you haven't got the resources, or, you know, if you haven't got, if you're feeling confused, then maybe it's because you're lacking a vision or whatever it is. Certainly useful for me leading a product.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And all of those things, so from my knowledge of digital strategy, all of those 5 things apply. I would always look at that. The one that's hard to reconcile in teaching is incentives. Kind of thing. So in the strategy that I'm just implementing at the moment, I'm giving out Surface Pros. That's the incentives. Looking at, I've given 1 hour's training, which isn't very much, but I'll give more training through resources that I will have set up and done the thing. The vision I've shared and it's clean and clear. And the action plan equally. The strategy steps over 4 years and doesn't go too fast. It's like slow travel, my digital strategy. I think that's good. It works. I'm just trying to think if there are any holes in it. I'm trying to think of things that, and that's from 1987. I'm trying to think of things that, if there's anything else to add.
Well, I suppose the thing which has changed most since 1987 in the last, 31 years is technology. But I'm not sure how you'd put that in there.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Well, I would say that's you'd argue resources, it's covered in resources. Really, that the technology is sufficient to achieve, if it's involved, to achieve the whatever's setting out to be changed, that it works well enough and all of that. And people have had to deal with inadequate technology many, many, many different years and times.
I don't think incentives is necessarily the right word. I think there's other ways. Like you could think about alignment, you could think about consensus, etc. But I think the output is the same, resistance.
Yeah, I've got the idea of recognition in my mind for some reason. I think
right, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Recognize people because that I'm just thinking back to the Royal Society, the RSA, Royal Society of Arts, that did that thing about how money is not incentivizing. You can pay people loads more, they won't do a better job, but if you recognize them, that is what people seek, acknowledgement and recognition of their contributions. Mm.
Well, on that, it might be worth just moving on to the next one, which is, I've got another diagram in this one. This is from Harvard Business Review. The best teams are cognitively diverse and psychologically safe.
Are they now? Cognitively diverse, psychologically safe. That makes sense.
So the diagram has four quadrants in it, from low to high on cognitive diversity going up the y-axis. And psychological safety from low to high on the x-axis. And so I guess that the best teams are in the top right quadrant, which is labeled as generative. And those kind of behaviors are listed as curious, encouraging, experimental, forceful, inquiring, and nurturing.
I wonder if those words are pitched against each other in the two columns, so cautious against curious. Work, controlling against encouraging, works, flexible against experimental, I'm not sure about that. Hierarchical against forceful, I'm not sure about that. Reasoned against...
No, you've mismatched those.
Not in my diagram.
Cautious and curious, conforming and encouraging, controlling and experimental, directive and forceful, hierarchical and inquiring, and resistant and nurturing.
Resistant and nurturing. Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I get you.
I think you skipped one. But we don't have to talk about our respective organizations, but it's interesting, if you're listening to this, thinking about what kind of culture or what your team is like and which quadrant you'd fit into. I think anyone who leads a team would like to think that their team is generative, but is that actually true?
Well, I think it's an interesting thing, isn't it? So you get the idea, if I were to survey 150 teachers at my school to say whether they feel as a school we are curious, I don't know. But then you boil it back down to the idea we have autonomy in the classroom as teachers. You can be as curious as you want, as experimental as you want, kind of thing. I think it's...
It's perhaps worth defining the terms as well. I think cognitive diversity is obvious enough. And I do like the way that people are talking about cognitive diversity. It's obviously important to have diversity in terms of women and minorities. I think that's important too. But as lots of people have pointed out, if you have a workforce which, gets to fantastic levels of diversity in terms of women and people of color and all that kind of stuff, you could still have not very much cognitive diversity because everyone could actually have been from a very similar middle class background or whatever, or come from the same kind of school or whatever. So I think cognitive diversity, there's obvious value in having that. But I think it's important to define psychological safety. So perhaps we should use that quotation there, the first one.
Psychological safety is the belief that one will not be punished or humiliated for speaking up with ideas, questions, concerns, or mistakes. It is a dynamic, emergent property of interaction and can be destroyed in an instant with an ill-timed sigh. Without behaviors that create and maintain a level of psychological safety in a group, people do not fully contribute. And when they don't, the power of cognitive diversity is left unrealized. Furthermore, anxiety rises and defensive behavior prevails. I think that's a fair shout. But I think it's a difficult thing, isn't it? In an organization of many, then if you're going to encourage people to all have their say, it can be difficult. Although I did say at briefing before the holiday at my particular school, I said we had this. Let's talk about this. With this request to stop the use of large.
Yeah, how did that go?
Well, I asked for comment via email, and I received, like, say, half a dozen possible concerns. Some just like, please don't do this to me. Others explaining why they thought it was happening and trying to reason.
So to recap for those listening, this was turning off email turning off email. Centrally held mailing list, is that right?
Yeah, so centrally built distribution lists of like 200 people, like a whole year group or all of the staff or something like that, you know, big groups. So if people made their own distribution list, they could use them to their heart's content. We looked at how to enforce it, and actually, technically speaking, to enforce it, we would have to either limit teachers to only being able to send email to a certain number of people, say 50, 60, less than 100, whatever it might be. Because of the size of our school, because they're 200 in a year group, or remove the distribution list completely. And there are because systems are the way systems are. So our MIS would allow our management information system would allow us to, you can select a group of people and then send an email to them. So you can just go and pull up the lists that are within the MIS and then email that list, as it were. It would not be a distribution list as such. So we wouldn't be able to turn that off and without affecting the functionality of the system. In other ways. So anyway, so I reflected on why we were doing this and what the purpose of it was, and it wasn't my original idea. I was quite happy to push back against it because it was something that was sort of sprung upon me. And on reflection, I just thought, this is not the way that I do things. I don't force people into certain behaviors. I encourage them towards what I consider to be positive behaviors. So what we're doing instead is just setting up the broadcast messaging system. So if you want to communicate with a whole group of people, you do it through the broadcast messaging system, and which will just be like bulletins of a certain type. But we're going to limit the bulletins to sort of tweet length. Each bulletin entry would be tweet length and contain specific information with a read more link in it. And that will, so at the moment, our broadcast announcements are printed and collected by a pupil and brought to dining rooms and read out. And so that's going to change as well, probably. And I'm looking to read if, you know.
Okay, I mean, it goes back to, you know, I was talking about the product management course before. I can't remember if we were talking about this before we hit record or not. But, I think you mentioned something about Swivel and about kind of a teacher coming to you with a particular issue and then you basically questioning that and looking at what the thing was behind the request, which this product management course I'm doing, it kind of encourages you to do. You don't just accept whatever the users ask you to include in the product. It's a similar kind of thing here, isn't it? Like there's obviously a particular behavior which is problematic, but instead of having a almost knee-jerk reaction of doing something from a technology, it's a human problem which is manifested in a technological way. And I think that your approach of being a bit more nuanced about it, not forcing people to do things and getting them to understand the consequence of their actions, is more important and it has a bigger long-term effect than a short-term kind of let's turn off mailing lists for a while.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And so it feels much better to me, it always does, when you're not trying to force people's hands into certain behavior, but you're actually encouraging towards something that where the grass is shiny green, you know. And and indeed, when they arrive, the grass is actually greener.
Right. Not just,
anyway. And that's the idea, isn't it? I mean, that's what you want with change. So if you go back to our previous one and look at the sort of vision and the resources and all of that, the change plan and that kind of thing, action plan.
Right. And if you do all of this for something, you know, for something like this, for like, we've got a problem with the mailing list, and you go, okay, well, we need a vision here, we need some resources, we need this, we need that. It's always seen as overkill, and like, oh, surely we just need to turn off the mailing list. Like, what's the problem here? Mm-hmm. But actually, understanding the problem and having a much more nuanced solution leads to longer term effect. But then you can't prove a negative, so you can't say what would happen had you gone with the other approach. So it's very difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. And but it's also just sense and sensibility, isn't it? You don't want to. So if you look at this diagram that we're looking at, cognitive diversity versus psychological safety, and looking at creating a successful team, I'm quite happy to publicly say we're going to do this. We're now not going to do this because we listened to you. Do you know what I mean? Because it's not in a fake way at all. It's very genuine. It's exactly what we did. Is we listened to what people had to say and thought, okay, well, maybe this isn't the right move, and we should consider another method. And that makes us, what does it make us? I don't know. Makes us something good on this diagram. It means that we're listening. And flexible, I guess, you know, and all of that kind of thing, and encouraging, and you want to be, I don't know. Why is forceful up there on generative?
Like forceful in your, like you hold opinions, like you have strong opinions about stuff, I would say.
Okay, so it's like you're backing yourself, basically.
Yeah. Kind of.
Right, we should come to the end of our merry venture.
We should, and let me just tell you a story. So,
oh, fabulous.
33 years ago, I was 4 years old, and we just moved to the northeast of England. And my parents took me to the Quayside Market in Newcastle. And the Quayside Market, as it sounds, as you'll know, Di, is next to the River Tyne. So, you know, a potentially dangerous place for kind of a, not quite a toddler, but a young child to be. And so there I was, and nobody really knows what happened, but my sister was still in the buggy and was being kind of pushed around in the pushchair, and I was supposed to cross a line of people and go to my grandmother, but I never actually made it, and I got lost. And I can kind of still remember the thought process I went through, and I looked around, and I'd been told to go back to where I last found people, etc. Couldn't find them, and I just walked back to the car, which was, you know, half a mile away and round some corners, etc. So I just went back and I sat with this monkey that had been bought for me, this fluffy monkey that went around my neck. And I sat on the bonnet of the car, and I can still remember the number plate of that car, Matt 474V, this orange Ford Escort. And I sat there until my parents came back with the police, you know, 45 minutes later. And so ever since then, 33 years ago, we're still not in a position where we can, apart from holding a kid's hand or giving them a smartphone, like we're still not very good at keeping tabs on kids. And so I've seen, you know, people use reins on children, which seems to be less of a thing now, but I've certainly still seen those out and about. We give kids, as soon as we feel like they're old enough, a smartphone of their own, or we just limit their ability to roam, which is why I thought this thing called Lynq, LYNQ, which is being crowdfunded on Indiegogo, and I think has got like 1,000% of its initial funding, was such a really, really good idea. And I wondered what your thoughts of this were.
Okay. Well, I've just turned it on because you just mentioned its name. Right. Let's have a look. So it's like a dongle with a hole in one side, and I'm imagining it gives you a GPS location to your phone.
Well, that's the thing. It doesn't use GPS.
What does it use?
So it's like a carabiner, so it can clip onto anything, and clip onto your pet's collar, onto a kid's bag, whatever. And it's got a single button, so it's easy enough for a kid to use. And if you watch the video, basically what it does is it uses some kind of proprietary technology. We put it for open source, but whatever. And it can communicate on more than Bluetooth range, so hundreds of meters, and can tell you where the person is, the other thing, the other version of this other link, in comparison to you. So it shows the direction, how far it is away, and then when you're close, it says that the person is close by, or the carabiner thing, the link is close by. But you can do more advanced things. You can add like a almost like a geofence, so you can say that the child or the dog or the thing which is holding this device, this link, has gone outside of the radius that you've put upon it. Different things like that. And I just thought it was such a great idea. It's going to go into production, and it's not actually going to be ready until November. We're going to be going interrailing around Europe in the summer. And if it had been ready before that, I definitely would have bought one for my kids, because my youngest is sensible. My eldest is likely to wander off. So I definitely would have put one of those on his bag. But I just thought it was such a great idea.
No, it's fabulous, isn't it? I mean, it's a great idea for more things than that. So you imagine you just like, I've just taken my guitar to Spain and back, and I do, you know, I've had it since I was 18. I do worry that it would disappear. And it would be kind of cool to just put it in the case, so I always know how far away my guitar is from me when it's not actually with me, that kind of thing. And then they cite things in here, like at festivals and things like that, you can track your friends down really easily. And that sounds like a really good idea.
There's so many things that come out which are like solutions looking for a problem, whereas this seems to be like, there is a definite problem in the world, and this has been manufactured to help solve some of it. So I think it's great.
Yeah. I heard an interesting quote on something I read or watched or something, which was, it's not a problem if there isn't a solution. I thought that was great. So if we could just go back to the ideas of innovation and progress, this is an innovation that makes progress without question. This is a really, really useful piece of kit to have, I think. I would have liked this when my children were younger, and at least I'd know that I could let them roam more freely.
Because it also means that they're not being tracked by like one of the organizations we were talking about before, like Google or Apple or whatever. We're not allowing them to be an intermediary. Like these devices are talking immediately to each other in the same way that a walkie-talkie, you know, and I think that's probably what we'll end up taking around Europe with us. You know, walkie-talkies directly connect to each other without some kind of intermediary. And I think that one of the projects in general a society needs to do is to de-intermediate the connections that we have with the people. Like, we need to connect more directly to people rather than through services which are tracking our every move.
And can you tell me what's the distance? It says features at a glance, up to 3 miles. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking, because when we go on Gold DV, which I'll be going on again in the next month, up in the Peak District, I think, when we go up there, we have these things. The children, every group carries a GPS tracker with them. And then we have websites and mobile phones that can, you know, you text a number and it tells you their location. And then you pick the location up on a map or whatever, on GPS map. And this would be, but what you have to do is go and walk out to meet them somewhere. And hopefully they're on their path and it's all going to be good. And you're receiving text messages from whoever's back at base, kind of giving them their current location. And you hope that that's accurate and all is well. But this device looks as though it'd be kind of cool. So we'll just say, oh, you're this far away from them and blah, 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 blah. It'd be quite good.
Well, without wanting to prolong this podcast any further, really, much as I'm enjoying the conversation, I'm just thinking about people listening to it. A few years ago, I'll just put this BBC News article in. One of the things I really enjoy about browsing repositories, sorry, I can't do two things at the same time. BBC News article about mesh networks. One of the things that I really enjoy about perusing repositories such as FDroid, which is a free software, open source repository you can get for your Android phone, is when you peruse those things, the people who have created these projects, these apps, etc., have done so because they're scratching an own itch. Like they felt a need for this in their life. They're not just trying to make money from stuff. And in fact, it's all kind of free and open source. And there's quite a few on FJoy, there's quite a few mesh networks. And if you think about it in terms of providing access to everybody at a low cost, mesh networks are the way that things should happen. So in Devon, which is where my in-laws live, they have recently got very fast broadband through a mesh network. And that is provided by, I think there was some kind of funding from like Rural Fund. And they looked at all different solutions, and a mesh network was the best way of doing it. So it's basically relayed around connection to a connection, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So there's all these different mesh networks. There's one called Serval Mesh. There's one called Tink, T-I-N-C. There's one called, there's various other ones. There's one called FireChat, which I think was talked about 3 or 4 years ago. So you only need a single device connected to the internet, and that mesh networks with other devices which are authenticated within the network. And so for local chatting without the internet, you can do all kinds of stuff. There's one called Scuttlebutt, which is, it's scuttlebutt.nz. So this is for people who sail on ships and have some kind of spotty internet connection. And they can basically take their internet or take their social network with them, and then when they can reconnect, it kind of syncs everything, and it's almost like an asynchronous social network, and it's very resilient and fault tolerant. And I feel like we're so used to everything being so always on, instantly connected and stuff, that we don't think about different scenarios and also about what we actually want. Like, let's say the whole world is connected with super fast broadband and whatever. Like, what do we actually want in life? That's the important thing.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. No, it's like the idea. I teach mesh networks, and this will be useful to reference when I do.
I'll put the link into Serval Mesh as well. I think it's quite experimental compared to some of the ones, but it's worth having a look.
So I'm just wondering whether this relates to
an Android phone. Obviously, Apple sensor, is that the right word? No. Review things for the App Store. And so things like Telegram, which is an app which Moodle and millions of users use worldwide, because Telegram was in dispute with the Russian government, Apple didn't accept their update for a couple of months, which meant they weren't GDPR compliant on the date, which is a bit of a problem. And interestingly, when they've updated, I think, to version 1.4 or whatever it is today, one of the major feature updates is that they've increased censorship resistance in the app, which I think is awesome.
Oh, okay. That's a good thing. Cool. That looks really interesting.
Okay.
Fabulous. What are you up to?
What? Sorry, go on.
What are you up to? I said.
What am I up to? Well, I've got 3 weeks at home, which is great. We're starting the first MoodleNet sprint. So Moodle doesn't really work in sprints as such. Sprints are very common to kind of software development methodologies. You work for kind of 2 or 3 weeks on a particular thing, and then you celebrate the things that you've managed to achieve in that particular time frame. So we're starting the first MoodleNet sprint, Mael and I, tomorrow. We're going to do Wednesday to Wednesday for various reasons, which are too boring to go into here. I'll be at home for the next 3 weeks, which is great because the World Cup is starting next week. And I'll be in Barcelona and then in America and then interrailing around Europe. How about you?
I won't be around Europe as far as I'm aware. I will be in the next week. I will be teaching.
Cool.
So, pretty much, nothing exciting planned. Teaching, making some resources for the Surface Pros to go out to teachers. Helping and supporting them with that, and planning for next year really is what we're doing. Kind of good. All good.
Excellent. Okay, we're well, given that I'm at home and you're teaching and stuff, we should be able to put out weekly episodes of this. So let's see if we can manage that.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Cool. Lovely. It's been good to chat. And I hope you enjoyed listening. If you listened to the whole of this and got here, you crazy fool.
Congratulations. That's been tied 103.
And I'm just going to sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on the dock of a bay, wasting time.